change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello again, and welcome to another episode of the Nonprofit Snapcast. I'm your host, Mickey Desai. Lucky to be still speaking with Jack Silverstein. Jack, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
And this episode, I wanted to ask you about fundraising myths. You've said that most money comes from events to fundraising is the same as sales. I'm not sure I'm reading that correctly, but how do we set off on that conversation? What do you mean when most money comes from sales? Is that what you're saying?
No. What I'm saying is people think most money comes from events. So when you talk to, you know, the uninitiated and you tell them that you're a fundraiser, which I think is a very noble profession, they say, oh, you must do a ton of events. Or they'll say that, you know, oh, you're approaching all these businesses for gifts. And that's really, really not the case. You know, events are, as we all know, one piece of the pie when it comes to fundraising with direct mail or planned giving or campaigns or annual gifts. Events is just one small component of it. And events are traditionally arm's length fundraising. Yeah. So, you know, people come to the event, not necessarily to support the cause. They're coming to the event to either golf because they love golfing or to hear a speaker or to, you know, have an experience they wouldn't otherwise be able to get.
Right. Right. So it's almost a cultural thing and not necessarily a philanthropic thing.
Most definitely. And that's why, for the most part, at least in Canada, the vast majority of your event admission is not a charitable gift. So you can't claim it on your taxes. There's a difference in between, you know, someone who gives you, you know, $1,000 to sponsor an event and someone who gives you $1,000 to your charity and just, you know, for the best use of the charity.
Right. Exactly.
Right. There's a huge difference.
Yeah.
And I found that, you know, the businesses as well, the vast majority of money comes from individuals. And the individuals may own a business, and that may be where the check comes through the business, but that's their own, you know, tax planning themselves. But you're approaching them as an individual. They may happen to donate through the business. I think of businesses as people where there's not specifically a person who's in charge of the business, like a bank or a utility company or a telecom company. You know, it's done by a committee. It's not necessarily one person who makes those decisions. The vast majority of gifts are by individuals.
Right.
Right. And people always think, oh my goodness, you know, that it's businesses that are driving it. And it's really not. And I think that businesses have to be really strategic as to which organizations they align with.
Right. Well, I mean, and I don't know if we're bleeding over into the topic of sponsorship philanthropy. Sponsorships are, I mean, you know, still for the bang for the buck, individual giving is going to yield more fuel for a mission than sponsorships will, I think.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
You know, in events, they usually say that, you know, it's going to cost you 50 cents to raise a dollar.
Yeah.
It's kind of a good rule of thumb when it comes to events. So they're a pretty costly way of bringing in money. But if you look at a major gift program or even a bequest program, you know, those are probably about 5 to 10 cents to raise a dollar. So it's a much bigger bang for the buck. But the trade-off is that, you know, an event is finite. You know, you have a golf tournament, you can only have so many golfers on the course at one given time. This is what you get to be a gold sponsor. This is what you get for your bronze or silver. And, you know, take it or leave it. Whereas a donor, if you ask them for $100,000 and they come in at $80,000, what do you do?
Right.
Right. If the lead sponsorship of your event is $100,000 and someone comes in at $80,000, you say, hey, maybe you won't be the lead, but you could be a, you know, bronze or a silver sponsor.
Right.
There's a set benefit package. But when it comes to philanthropy, there isn't that rule.
Right. So, you know, I'm trying to think of the logistical difference in like just human resources planning. How do I take my development staff? And in most cases, I imagine, you know, small to medium sized nonprofits may not even have a dedicated development person. It may be all up to the executive.
Right.
But how do we make sure we're not burning our wheels unnecessarily on things like sponsorships and events when, you know, the individual donor game is by far and away yielding more bang for the buck?
Yeah. And, you know, I think it has to come with how we supervise and how we manage, you know, these staff. Yeah. And to you know, really ease up a little bit on the pressure to make sure that they're out there raising the dollars, which is a little bit hard to do in COVID, where, you know, everyone is panicking as to, you know, where are we going to get our next dollar from? But the reality is that I think that the staff need to have the bandwidth to be able to make those long-term relationships work. And I think moves management would be a great tool to measure. You know, there are some measurements out there that kind of say, well, how many visits are you on with donors per month? And it's really kind of making sure that those are moves managements that are going forward and proper steps. And so it's less of the focus about the dollars and cents that are coming in. So it's, you know, it's a two-pronged approach. And I think a lot of times, what we ask for in sponsorship, we really don't want a sponsor. We want a donor for that.
Right.
And we use those words interchangeably, and it's a disservice.
Oh, how do you figure?
Well, you know, we always say that we want a sponsor for our early literacy program, you know, for instance. Well, you don't want a sponsor, you want a donor.
Yeah.
Right? You know, a sponsor has some set rules, and they may have, there's some parameters around the gift. You want someone that basically strokes a check and says, here, you guys use this for this purpose. I'm not going to put, you know, restrictions on how you use it, but you use it to your best ability. And I think that that's really the, you know, the biggest difference, you know, but people use sponsorship and donation interchangeably. And I think that there's a difference when it comes to sponsorship. There's a list of benefits that people will get. Oh, you know, if you're a bronze sponsor, you get your name here, here, and here, blah, 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 blah. But if you're a philanthropic sponsor, you don't get anything. As a matter of fact, in Canada, you cannot receive a benefit. If you receive a benefit, it's actually deducted from the value of your gift.
Right.
So, you know, they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart. We may thank them and say, hey, you know, Mr. Smith, thanks so much for your gift. We'd love to put your name up on this room. That's a different thing.
Right.
But, you know, we certainly aren't going to say, well, gee, you know, your name is going to be on our website and blah, 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 blah. It's of no use to an individual to have, you know, the John Doe building.
Exactly. Yeah. And I don't think that a sponsorship is completely tax deductible here in the States either, but I'm a little rusty right. on that mechanism. I think there's a formula that people use for benefit derived and things like that.
But, Yeah. And I know that even for businesses, a tax receipt is of no use to them because they write it off as a marketing expense. There's exactly. No difference between sponsoring a golf tournament and putting an ad in the local newspaper.
Right.
Right. And it comes from usually from a marketing budget as opposed to a philanthropic budget.
Right. Huh. Jack, I've also heard you say that doing more with less is insulting and that there should be a position to take on why development offices should be sacrosanct during this crisis. How do you, can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. You know, everyone's first knee-jerk reaction during COVID was to slash and burn. Mm-hmm. And there are many charities I know that have slashed their fundraising departments. And it's so counterintuitive. You know, the fundraising departments are bringing in money and people were looking to actually support the different charities. It's, you know, like turning off a faucet midway. You know, you have the water coming out. Now, I believe that the events folks, they're in a different world. And some of them have been able to pivot to virtual events. Some of them have not been able to do that. And, you know, if your whole job was working on a golf tournament, odds are better than not, you're going to be furloughed for a while.
Yep.
You know, but I think that those, when they say, you know, doing more with less, when you hear that, there's the assumption that, you know, well, you're just kind of squandering money and you're wasteful. And I haven't met any professional in the nonprofit world that doesn't put in well over 100% effort. Right. And so to say that you got to do more with less, firstly, you're assuming that they have everything they need to begin with, which is rarely the case.
Right. Exactly.
Right. So to make a blanket statement, you know, years ago, I worked for an organization. They wanted you to do a budget. And before they read the budget, they actually said, well, we're just cutting everyone's budget by 10% across the board. Well, when I learned that silliness, the following year, I just padded my budget. Right. If you're going to make a silly you know, thing like, oh, we're just going to cut 10%. Well, it makes no sense. Mm-hmm. Right. So doing more with less, I find horribly insulting because it assumes that, you know, there's extras to be had. I once had a volunteer that asked me and said, Jack, how do we raise another $1 million a year net contribution for our organization? And I said, well, go get me three more fundraisers.
Right.
And they wouldn't do it.
Wow. Okay.
And I said, like, it's an investment, but it's going to, you know, obviously have to give the fundraiser some time to kind of reap the benefits. But, you know, it's an investment. It's not an expense.
Yeah.
And I think that sometimes most people don't understand what fundraisers do or how they do it. And so there's kind of that magic that happens in, you know, Disney somewhere. And lo and behold, there's the money that you need.
Right.
And the more successful the fundraisers are, the more that that myth is kind of entrenched in folks is, oh, well, give it to, you know, Jamie. She knows what she's doing and she'll be able to raise lots of money. Well, the more Jamie's able to do that, the less likely they are to go and get assistance for Jamie.
Yeah.
Right. So it's, you know, but it's such an insulting statement because, you know, everyone's in the nonprofit world. Everyone is realizing that for every dollar you spend, it's a dollar that's not going to the mission.
Right.
So we all buy into that. So there isn't waste. You know, listen, can every charity tighten their belts a little bit? Definitely. Definitely. But when you come up with a blanket statement, you got to do more with less. It's an insulting statement.
And it reinforces the notion that nonprofits are not as good at doing business as for-profits are. And I think the opposite is true.
Right.
Yeah. I just did a recording yesterday on the same thing. You know, the notion that nonprofit business people are not as effective as the for-profit folks is absolutely false. And we've been having to do more with less for a long time, while being surrounded with people who are wondering why we have overhead at all. And,
right.
And yeah, so.
Right. You know, if you think about it, the return on investment for a fundraiser is pretty amazing. And, you know, if you were to put that into the for-profit world, you know, we take a look at what is the cost to raise a dollar, well, you flip it and that's your return on investment. That would be any business's dream to have ratios like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the pressure is so ridiculous. Oh, you spent 25 cents to raise a dollar. Why is it only, why can't you do it for 5 cents?
Right.
And you know, there's something to be said. And obviously there's economies of scale that are out there. But I think that really saying that this is a great investment, it's a great bang for the buck.
Mm-hmm.
And not treating everything as an expense, treating it as an investment.
Right. You know, we are talking sort of about perceptual change. It's almost a cultural change. How do we get development folks to foster that change or that perceptual difference? Do we hand everybody a business card that has the word sacrosanct on it?
That would be kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? I think it's a lot of it has to do with education. And I think fundraising has come a long way in 25 years. You know, my first capital campaign I ever ran, we did things on index cards and we did ditto machines for pledge forms.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit of a different world. It's more sophisticated these days. And there are programs in universities and colleges that actually teach people how to work and run nonprofits. So I think it's coming along in a great way. Where I think there's the disconnect is there's still people who don't understand what fundraising is all about. So I think it's an education tool.
Yeah.
Is really what, and I think every opportunity that the fundraising staff can get in front of the board of directors and talk about, well, let's manage expectations. So if the expectation in Canada is that, you know, your cost to raise a dollar with Canada Revenue Agency, it should be about 35 cents or less. Well, if you're at 20 cents, you're doing pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Right. It's just managing those expectations. If you believe that it should be at 5 cents, then you're dreaming in Technicolor.
Right.
Right. So I think it's all an education. And I think really learning how to manage these expectations and what would make sense on a go forward basis. You know, people, one of the myths that I always talk about is people think that in the charity world, you're going to have staff with you for, you know, 20, 30 years, and they're going to get that gold watch.
Yeah.
Well, firstly, no charity gives a gold watch.
Exactly.
And secondly, nobody lasts now in any position for 20 or 30 years. They say a college graduate will go through 9 careers, not 9 jobs, 9 careers in their life.
I believe it. So many of my peers, when I was in the corporate sector back in the early 2000s, the only way they could get a raise was by jumping ship.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that, you know, just managing those expectations. So I think that, you know, the Association of Fundraising Professionals says that the average tenure should be 18 to 36 months for a mid-level fundraiser. So if you're getting 5 years, you're doing absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
But if your board is under the impression that people are there for 20 or 30 years until they get the golden watch, there's going to be a huge disconnect.
Right. Yeah. Huge disconnect. That's right. So it is just a matter about telling the story.
Yep.
And doing more education about what the reality for fundraisers really is.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, fundraising used to be this kind of unknown thing. And it was almost like a dirty word that people would, you know, oh, you're a fundraiser. I could never go out and beg for money. And that's, you know, another one of those things that just tick me off to no end. I don't beg anyone for money.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, most of my great fundraising visits, I never even ask for money. I share with them what's going on. And they all say to me, oh, Jack, what do you guys need?
Wow.
And we get into a discussion. Well, how much is that? Oh, okay. And then they're on that journey, but I'm not specifically going in and necessarily asking them for a gift. I'm sharing that story with them.
I'm sitting here nodding. You can't see me, but I'm nodding. And I'm like, yes, absolutely. Well, yeah. I mean, that's the way to do it. I, you know, when I do it, I try to end my story with not even an ask, but sort of an invitation. I hope you'll join us in supporting this.
And, yeah.
But yeah, to hear you say that you don't even make an ask, that's really remarkable to me.
My best visits are where there's not an ask.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my best visits is where the donor drives it. And, you know, you may find that you were going in for, you know, for them to fund project A, but in your discussion, you're really finding they're passionate about project B, which you really had no idea that they would be passionate about.
Right.
If you go in with kind of all your cards and your proposal already done up, you have no wiggle room. If you go in as an exploratory meeting, you can certainly say, hey, you know what? Let me get you some more information about Project B.
Right.
And, you know, in the book, I also talk about saying, if your organization doesn't do Project B, I've actually sent some donors to other charities.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. And people say, oh my gosh, you could never, you know, it's going to hurt my charity. Not a chance.
Yeah.
Their donations have not gone down one iota. As a matter of fact, it just cements you as a trusted professional. You know, I have many donors that will still call me to this day. I haven't really dealt with them in years that will say, Jack, I'm thinking about investing in charity ABC. What do you think?
Yeah.
And we have a discussion about it. But I've become kind of a consigliere there.
Exactly. I like that. That's a very cool. You're developing trust at the least, right? That's
most definitely. And That's really what major gift fundraising is all about. If it was all about kind of grabbing as much money as quickly as you could, you might do it once, but you would have a pretty shallow donor pool.
Right. So your book, Tales from the Trenches, What I Learned from 25 Years in Fundraising, is already available for pre-order. It'll hit the market the 1st of December.
You got it.
And you when you wrote to me, you said my first book. Does that mean you have a second one in the works somewhere?
So it's funny. So, you know, people know that I've been writing a book. So they're like, oh, so what's your next one going to be? Well, thanks so much. But let's get the first one out there. I'm starting to think of trying to get some real practical tools. That fundraisers can use. These are anecdotes that are in there and, you know, kind of tales from the trenches. You know, and it's interesting, the word campaign is only used in politics, war, and fundraising. So that's where I always kind of talk about the war stories and tales from the trenches. But, you know, having some real practical concepts in there as to, you know, how much should you be asking for a first-time donor? Some real things that folks can go and take away and implement in their own shops.
Right.
I think is going to kind of be what my next book is going to be about.
Very cool. I can't wait to hear about it. And if a listener wanted to be in touch with you with any questions or needed to find your book, how would they do that?
They can find my book on Amazon, or they can go to www.yucks.ca.
Jack, this is wonderful stuff. I hope we can do more of these in the future at some point. In the meantime,
definitely.
Thank you for being my guest on the Snapcast, and hope you and yours are staying safe for the holidays.
Thanks. You too, Mickey. Mm-hmm.
This has been the Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.